I remember a patient I saw when I first came to the US, you know, nearly 30 years ago. It was a UCLA student that wanted to get fit, and he was running up and down this hill dressed in a sweater because he wanted to get a good sweat on, and it was about 100 degrees outside. And he came in, and at first he was just a little bit altered, but then quickly he got away from us. So even though we were cooling him and he started seizing, he developed DIC, and he died in front of us within an hour. It was terrible.
Yikes. Did I get your attention? That was Melvis back in July of last year in a little snack that he did. We're getting into that time of year when such a huge proportion of our collective patient population, basically the whole northern hemisphere, is exposed to extreme heat. It's a good time to review the priorities in the resuscitation of these really sick patients with heat stroke and to see if anything's new. So in the way of background, I would definitely recommend taking a listen to Mel's piece last year, and we'll link to that. And I'm pleased to bring you Dr. Bob Paquette, who for many, many years now has been a favorite of the clinical teaching staff at LA County USC. He's an associate professor at the Keck School of Medicine, and it's a real pleasure to finally have Bob on MRAP. It's been many years of me trying to cajole him in here to share his wisdom.
Bob Paquette.
So, Bob, we're going to focus today on the treatment, the contemporary treatment of the patient who comes in really sick with accidental hyperthermia, the hot, altered patient that's in their apartment cooking and brought in by the police, that scenario. But just before we dive into it, let's just talk in the broadest sense about the patient who comes in hot and altered, just from the way that you approach it.
Well, of course, you always have to think about all the potential problems, right? There's endocrine issues like hyperthyroidism, of course, infectious issues. But with most of these heat stroke cases, you will usually get collateral information that will lead you towards a diagnosis. If the paramedics are bringing in a grandma from a non-air-conditioned apartment, they'll say, yeah, it was really hot in there. And that's a huge clue as to what might be going on. Or conversely, at the county hospital where I work, you know, we get a lot of drug addicts. So someone's high on meth and they're running down the street in a leather jacket and it's 110 degrees outside. Usually there's not a huge diagnostic dilemma, but of course you always have to think about those other things. Making the diagnosis of heat stroke can be challenging at times. You know, when you look at the official diagnosis of it, they always talk about core temperature generally greater than 104 Fahrenheit and altered mental status. And those are certainly key elements. Most of these people are not just 104. Frequently, they're much higher than that. They'll have core temperatures of 106, 107, 108 is actually pretty common.
And just to provide some quick Celsius conversion, we're talking basically about temperatures above 40 degrees Celsius in the 40 to 42 range here.
And the nice thing about that is it does remove most of the rest of the differential. Generally speaking, endocrine conditions are not going to give you a core temperature of 107. I mean, you can argue maybe rarely, but generally not. Very few other things will do that other than a heat stroke scenario.
Bob, as someone who's seen a lot of cases of this, and we've both seen a lot of cases, in your mind, what is the one thing that throws people off the diagnosis more than anything else?
Probably the most important problem most clinicians have with heat stroke is focusing on the dry skin versus wet skin. When you look at the biggest mistakes where people really dropped the ball and really missed obvious cases of heat stroke, what the clinician was doing was they were focusing often on the classic heat stroke presentation that's described in medical school. And classic heat stroke is the elderly woman who has multiple medical problems on multiple medications, who's usually sitting in, again, a hot apartment, non-air conditioned. When that patient comes...
I just realized you just described my mother now, starting to panic. But yes, that's basically the scenario. I mean, that's the classic scenario, right?
Yeah, and in that scenario, that patient's skin very well may be dry. But that's very different from exertional heat stroke. An exertional heat stroke is usually a young, healthy athlete. It's the high school football player in summer practices. It's the military recruit. These are people in great shape, and they're working really, really hard physically out in the heat. And they come in and they're really sweaty. And what will happen is someone will say, okay, the patient was in a hot environment, they're altered, but they're really sweaty. And because they're sweaty, it cannot be heat stroke. And that can't be further from the truth. It just means that they have exertional heat stroke. And the classic example of that was Corey Stringer.
And it was one of the hottest training camps I've been involved in. Big K was right next to me and we're walking off. We've got our shoulder pads in our hands and all of a sudden he just drops.
Those of you who are football fans in the 90s remember Corey Stringer was on offensive tackle for the Vikings and they were in summer camp down in Louisiana, I believe. It was a hot day. He collapsed on the field and all of his teammates said he was babbling and he was completely nonsensical. The trainer brought him into an air-conditioned trailer and hooked him up to an IV, thought it was heat exhaustion. And his main reason, his argument for it being heat exhaustion, was that he was very sweaty and therefore it could not be heat stroke. Well, Corey sat in that trailer for about an hour and then he began to seize. At that time, they brought him to a local emergency room and his core temperature was 108. And unfortunately for Mr. Stringer, it didn't go too well. He ended up succumbing to his illness.
Well, that's a nice pick-me-upper, Bob. So I guess we're kind of 0-for-2 in our horrible stories now. Let's talk about preventing some of these tragic outcomes. First things first, we're going to talk about cooling because we actually think that cooling comes right up front in these patients right along with airway.
Yeah, well, cooling is certainly your first and primary priority with heat stroke. We know for sure that heat stroke is a high mortality disease entity, and the rate at which you cool them is completely linear to the mortality. So the faster you cool them, the lower the mortality. So that's got to be something you really emphasize.
I think it's a huge issue, right? Because just to stay there for a second, one of the reasons why people don't get cooled as rapidly as you and I would like to see in these cases is because the temperature is not taken fast enough, right? Let's talk about that.
Well, in fact, at our shop, it wasn't my case, but it was a case that was discussed at one of our M&Ms. There was a young man who came in as an agitated delirium. He was noted to be in a wide complex tachycardia that was thought to be a ventricular tachycardia, and he was actually shocked 2 or 3 times, and it wasn't until maybe 10 or 15 minutes into the case that someone actually realized that he was radiating massive amounts of heat and his core temperature was 108, and in fact, that was the underlying problem.
So it's a huge issue because sometimes the nurses will tell you, we'll get the temperature when we get the Foley in, and that might take 10, 15 minutes. And that's really important time when it comes to cooking your organs, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a vital amount of time. When a sick patient comes in, it can be a little disorienting. There's lots of things going on and you can get really distracted. I often found that the simplest thing I can do is just put my hand on the person's chest. Yeah. If someone is severely hyperthermic or hypothermic, you will know immediately because they're going to be strangely hot or strangely cold. And that should be your first tip. Hey, we need to get a rectal temperature right now because something is strange with their temperature.
Yeah, if I can fry an egg on this patient's chest, probably should get a rectal thermometer. Okay. Let's talk about the actual cooling. Once you've identified the temperature, it's important how you do this because it's got to be fast and you don't want to cause further complications, right? Tell me about that.
Yeah, so you have a couple options. You know, a very effective technique is immersion into an ice water bath, which is great, but it's really not practical for most community ER settings because most of us don't have a tub big enough for an adult. And a lot of these people are going to be intubated. If it's an older patient with multiple medical problems, you're trying to do a variety of monitoring. Sticking them in an ice bath isn't super practical. But at military bases like at Camp Pendleton, where they have a lot of military recruits, that is a standard technique. Someone goes down on the obstacle course, They drop the 19-year-old in the ice bath, and 15 minutes later, he's good to go.
And a bunch of our graduates provide services for some of the big rave parties throughout the state. And they have these setups where they have like 15 bathtubs full of ice all ready to go because that's their primary issue. That's the primary life threat that they face. So
yeah, it's a really effective field technique, especially at marathons or at a rave. For hospital settings, usually we do something more like evaporative cooling, which is where you strip the patient down. You're going to either mist them with water or pour water on their bodies and then have fans directly at their bare skin. A pitfall there, at our place, for quite a while, the nurses would want to place a wet sheet on top of the body and then put fans. The problem with that is the whole point is you want the water molecules evaporating off of the skin because in that process, it's going to pull heat directly off of the skin. If you put a wet sheet on top of the body, basically you're cooling the sheet, but you're not as directly cooling the skin. So no sheet, just bare skin with water on it, fans.
Now, how important is the temperature of the water? Because the classic teaching is that if you use water that's too cold, you're going to trigger a shivering response, kind of shoot yourself in the foot. How important is that?
That is a classic teaching point, is that, yes, ideally you're supposed to be misting with like lukewarm water. And the reason for that is if you were to spray, say, ice cold water onto the skin, it will trigger inappropriate thermogenesis shivering. And the reason for that is our bodies don't really detect our core temperature. Our bodies sense our temperature through the skin. So if the skin starts cooling rapidly, even though the core may still be at 105, 106, 107, it will still trigger a shivering response. Now, I personally have not found that to be a super concern. Number one, if you are rapidly cooling anyone, whether it's ice baths or whatever, you're going to trigger that effect. And in my emergency room, we tend to intubate almost all of these heat stroke patients anyway. And if they're going to be intubated, they're usually paralyzed. So it doesn't become an issue. But yes, that is a point that's made, but I think it's a minor one. And we can always get around that by giving benzodiazepines if, say, they weren't intubated. The other thing you can do, and we've been doing this quite a bit at our place, is just packing them in ice. You know, traditionally, they talked about putting ice packs around the neck or the axilla or the groin. And that's great. And we do that. But we'll actually put ice packs completely around the scalp, around the arms, on the hands, down the legs, and basically only leave their anterior trunk exposed to the fans and the mist. And the other thing you can do is using those cooling pads that were all the rage a few years ago when we were doing therapeutic hypothermia for post-arrest cases. It's a really nice way of cooling the person's back. Because over the years, I've noticed we would cool someone's anterior surface really well, but if you stuck your hand under their back was still really hot. If you have one of these cooling pads for therapeutic hypothermia, put it under them and that will cool their back at the same time. We have had some really good cases where between the evaporative cooling and packing people in ice, we've been able to get a core temperature down from 108 to 101 in about 20 minutes.
And that's kind of the time frame that people need to be thinking about, right? Because that is, it's really that primary survey, immediate first 15 minute time frame where this needs to be happening.
Yeah, literally every minute counts. And so that should be your goal, is to get them down to a normal physiologic temperature within that first 20 minutes or so.
That's actually a good segue, Bob. Tell us what you mean by a normal physiologic temperature.
And this leads to another important management item, which is the concept of overshoot hypothermia. People will frequently be very aggressively cooling a patient, which is great, and the temperature is coming down, which is great. But they end up trying to cool them to a core temperature of normal, of, you know, 98.6, 99. But the problem with that is if you cool someone to a core temperature of 98.6, their hands and their arms and their legs, all the periphery is actually much cooler at this point. It could be in the 80s, maybe even the high 70s, depending on what technique you're using. And if you stop cooling them at 98.6 core, their body temperature is going to keep drifting down. You can actually make them hypothermic. So the way you got to do this is when you're cooling, you actually want to stop when their core temperature hits around 101, maybe 102.
So that's in the 38.5 range for the Celsius folks.
The way I like to tell my residents is when someone hits a normal fever temperature is usually a good time to shut it off. So around 101, 102, shut it down and just dry them off, put a sheet on them at that point, and their core temperature will continue to drift down another point or two in the subsequent hour.
So Bob, you made a really important distinction there when you just talked about a normal fever temperature, because heat stroke and hyperthermia are not fever and shouldn't be treated as such, right?
Yeah, that's a really, really important point as well. And again, a common mistake people make is this isn't a fever. This isn't hypothalamus mediated. So medications like aspirin, NSAIDs, Tylenol will have absolutely no effect on this process. And not only are they completely ineffective, it actually will make things worse. When you have severe heat stroke, almost all of these patients will take a severe hit to their liver. They'll have a severe liver injury, possibly even liver failure. So pumping them full of Tylenol is not going to make that situation any better. They almost universally will have some level or some degree of renal failure. So pumping them full of NSAIDs is going to be deleterious. So no aspirin, no acetaminophen, no NSAIDs, because it's not going to help anything and it's only going to make it worse.
So Bob, we actually didn't talk about airway until after cooling, because I think we both feel strongly that it's an important priority that people underemphasize and that we really want to get them cool fast. And that probably is the number one priority, right? But the airway is going to need to be managed. Let's not make any bones about that. So talk to us about the airway management in these patients.
Yeah, so airway management in heat stroke. Unless you're catching the patient very, very early, again, someone just collapsed on the obstacle course or during a marathon where they're just starting to go into heat stroke, a lot of these patients, in fact, I would say most of these patients will require intubation. Certainly ones that come into my urban emergency room almost universally require intubation. And there's a really important point here to make about that. The one thing I would argue you have to do is you have to use rocuronium. I'm not one of these anti-succinylcholine people. I like succinylcholine. I use it all the time. But these heat stroke patients will very, very commonly have incredibly high potassiums. A large percentage of them are going to be in rhabdo, they're going to be in ATN, renal failure, and their Ks are going to be 7, 8, 8.5. And if you push sux on that, you will kill them. The other reason that ROC is really great for treating heat stroke is a typical dose of rocuronium is going to last anywhere from 30 minutes to 45 minutes.
And they won't shiver.
And they won't shiver. That's right. Absolutely. You know, it's the best medication out there to prevent shivering.
Yeah. A little cruel, but you give it with sedation.
Absolutely. And it's perfect because by the time the ROC is wearing off, you shall have cooled them, hopefully, you know, well within that time frame. So it really is a perfect medication for intubation.
Actually, we jokingly mentioned that, but if you're paralyzing someone, you are sedating them, and benzos are probably the way to go in most of these patients with hyperthermia.
Yeah, so if you're going to use a sedating agent while they're paralyzed, which of course you should, a benzo would be the perfect agent because seizures are very, very common in heat stroke patients. And so you're kind of killing two birds with one stone. You're getting them nice and relaxed and sedated so they'll tolerate the paralysis, but you're also going to help decrease their seizure risk.
And what about the vent settings? Do we need to adjust for the fact that they have a higher metabolic rate going on when they're extremely hot?
Yeah, I think one of the important issues to consider is you really want to have a higher minute ventilation. Again, these people are usually dry. They're usually acidemic. Their pH is going to be low. So starting them at a vent setting of 400 and a rate of 12 is probably bad because you're going to be underventilating. So I would probably start a higher rate, a higher tidal volume until you start getting blood gases back and you can start titrating your vent settings at that point.
So Bob, I have to be honest. I'm always a little paranoid in these cases about my fluid management. I'm afraid that I'm overshooting or undershooting. What's your take on fluid management and heat stroke?
One of the most common mistakes I see people make with fluid and heat stroke is, again, they kind of latch onto that classic teaching. Classic teaching with classic heat stroke, again, which is a little old lady, very comorbid, is that they're not very dehydrated and they don't need very much fluid. And that's generally true. So if you have a classic heat stroke patient, again, the polysick little old lady who is just cooking in her apartment, you know, 1 liter, maybe a liter and a half, and you're probably fine. But you got to remember, these exertional heat stroke patients, again, the young athlete that was outside working really hard, they can often be profoundly dehydrated. They could be 3, 4, 5 liters in the hole. And so you really want to aggressively treat those patients because they usually will require large volumes. And you're going to tell your management based on whether you think it's more of a classic heat stroke patient versus an exertional heat stroke patient.
And Bob, just to be specific in terms of your choice of fluid, I take it you start with normal saline because the last thing in the world you want to do is introduce more potassium until you know where you're at, but then after 1 or 2 liters, switching to a more balanced electrolyte solution?
Yeah, that's reasonable. You know, if I have a patient who clearly fits into that exertional heat stroke category, and I'm knowing in advance, I'm probably going to give them 4, 5, possibly even 6 liters of fluid. After that first liter or two of normal saline, I will usually try to switch over to LR at that point. That's ideal if you have that available. Rhabdo and renal failure and hyperkalemia are, again, very, very common in these heat stroke patients. And so I would certainly start with a normal saline. It's always a safer fluid to begin with, and then you can always transition at a later point. And then the other issue that comes up fluid-wise is the whole hyponatremia issue. When you have a lot of, especially exertional heat stroke kind of situations, marathon runners or whatever, they're exerting really hard. They're losing a lot of fluids and salts in their sweat, and then they're replacing it with a lot of free water. Hyponatremia can become an important issue. When a patient first comes in with heat stroke, they really are in a shock state. They're usually profoundly hypoperfusing. And your first goal is to resolve that hypoperfusion. So I wouldn't overthink about what types of fluids so much, you know, whether they need hypertonic or whatever. That's a later finding. So fix their hypoperfusion. That's normal saline, that's LR. And once that gets corrected, hopefully by that point, you have a chemistry or an ISTAT back, you'll know what the sodium is, and you can maybe fine tune your sodium therapy at that point.
Bob, just before we finish this discussion, I just want to round it out with one of your pet peeves, and this has actually been the subject of more than one M&M at our place, and that is the use of pressors in these patients.
You know, these heat stroke patients are going to be hypotensive, right? They're profoundly vasodilated and they're dehydrated. That's normal. So you can expect them to have systolic blood pressures usually somewhere in the 80s. But the mistake that is made is people want to hang Levofed or epinephrine or something on them. That's not the treatment. The treatment is fluids and cooling. By filling the tank with IV fluids and by vasoconstricting them through aggressive rapid cooling, that blood pressure will come up. The problem with pressors is because it does cause kind of system-wide vasoconstriction, it can actually decrease the body's ability to release heat. And so it can actually impair their ability to cool. So they don't need it, and it can actually make things worse. So no pressors.
Summary. Bob, informative as always. The quick summary, let me put it into a bit of a mantra or maybe some lyrical verse. As we enter the hot summer months in the Northern Hemisphere and patients arrive altered and extremely hot, temperatures greater than 104 or 40 degrees Celsius, you want to think about the broad differential diagnosis like meningitis and a head bleed and endocrine causes, but the higher the temperature goes, the less likely that this is something other than heat stroke. Fortunately, the immediate treatment is the same regardless, which is immediate cooling, which is the number one priority here. In most EDs, cooling is performed with a combination of ice packs and evaporative cooling using spray bottles and fans. Patients will frequently need intubation to facilitate further management and workup, and rocuronium is the agent of choice for RSI. Benzos are excellent for sedation because they will also deal with the propensity of these patients to seize, and aggressive cooling should be stopped when the patients get to a normal fever temperature of about 102 or about 38.5 Celsius. This is to prevent overshoot hypothermia. Fluid should be given generously in these patients to treat their shock, and normal saline is the place to start until their sodium level is known. Avoid NSAIDs, acetaminophen, and wherever possible, pressor agents, because they might make things a lot worse. Oh yeah, and one last thing. Let's not forget about our role in prevention and in educating people about how dangerous these heat waves are. No one said it better than Mel.
Stop running those kids around when it's boiling hot, and stop dressing them up in lots of clothing and having them bash into each other at football practice when it's 105 degrees outside. Oh, come on, for goodness sake, stop doing it. It's just not worth it. And for grandma, if you can't afford to cool the house and it's super hot, get yourself to the library. Get yourself to the mall. Get a good book, just go hang out. It's not creepy. I'm telling you, do it.
Exactly.